Welcome to The Burial Plot, horror podcast with Brenda Tolian and Joy Yaley.
Welcome to The Burial Plot, listeners. We're sorry that we've had to take a long break, but some of us were dealing with some stuff out of this world. But we're back now, and we're happy to be back. Here at The Burial Plot, we like to bring you the horrific, the strange, and the unusual in the world of books, writers, and the whole wide, wonderful horror genre. Today, we are joined by author P.L. McMillan. P.L. is a writer whose works have been known to cause rifts in time and space itself. Well, not quite, but writing often makes her feel that powerful. With a passion for cosmic horror and sci-fi horror, P.L. McMillan sees every shadow as an entryway to a deeper look into the black heart of the world, meant to be discovered and explored. Infatuated with the works of Shirley Jackson, H.P. Lovecraft, and Ridley Scott, her dream is to create stories of adventure, of chills, of heartbreak, and thrills. P.L. McMillan lives in Colorado with her large selection of teas, her husband, and her two chinchillas, Sherlock and Spuds, all under the supervision of their black cat overlords, Poe and Zurg. Hello, P.L., and welcome back to The Burial Plot. We're so happy to have you again.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
So tell us, last time you were here, you were here with the Howl Society.
That's
and
true.
And you were just getting ready to release an anthology that you had co-edited, I believe. Mm-hmm. Tell us how that did and how that experience was for you.
So that was Howls from the Dark Ages, which came out in May. It did really well. We sold out of like the special edition that we had done, and
that
it continues.
Beautiful, right?
Yeah, the artist did an amazing job, and then our designer really. Sacrificed who knows how much life's blood in getting the designs and the setup perfect as well. Grady Hendrix actually grabbed my copy, and I was like, you give that back. And he took it to his cover panel, and he like held it up to show people like, oh, this is like what people can be capable of. It's not just big name publishers that are able to do this. And I haven't washed the book since. Thanks, Grady.
I can't blame you there for sure. Yeah.
But it was definitely an interesting experience. That was the first time I was asked to co-edit an anthology. And it was stressful as well as a huge learning experience. You know, being put in the place of effectively gatekeeping what you think would be a good selling story is like a bit intense to feel, you know, that you have to make those decisions. And then the learning experience working with another co-editor, Morty is a bit of a control freak, so we often butted heads. I'm all about comma splices. Use them as you will, people. He hates them. He's more like, let's stick to being grammatically correct. So oftentimes when we did our copy editing, he would call them out and be like, you need to change this, and then I would comment, you can keep it if you want, and the author would see these little exchanges on the side. So but it was a good experience. Would I ever do it again? I'm not sure. I might if I were asked, I might solo edit. But co-editing was fine. But I feel like it almost is more work because you're working with somebody else, you're compromising. And I think my first priority will always be my writing. So while I like if a like editor or if a press was like, hey, we'd love it if you would edit this anthology, like we think you're hot stuff, P.L. McMillan, I'd be like, all right, I'll do it. But I guess I won't make, like, I'm not going to be going out there like applying for the position. I don't know how people become editors, to be honest. just because I want to focus mainly on my writing.
Gotcha. Yeah, the cover of that was really quite eye-catching, and the stories inside of the anthology are all really good. I really enjoyed that anthology. You're not going to edit anything soon on the horizon, which is fine, but I've always been interested in how anthologies are put together. I always have like this little bug in the back of my mind that I would like to someday maybe edit an anthology, put one together myself. But then it's kind of like, do I really want that responsibility of the gatekeeping? I'm not sure I can handle it.
And with the Howls anthology, it was also all the writers, excluding the guest authors, were Howls members. And just to reiterate, the Howls Society is a book club / writing group. You can find them online. You can join. It's an online Discord group. And so that almost made it more intense because, A, everyone is in this community together. They did a workshop to get their stories to the best forms they could be. And then everyone who submitted was a howler. So then you're like, oh, good. I get to crush the dreams of people that I know and have talked with for years. Great. Wow. So that almost made it a little more stressful. I think if it was just the more traditional process, and I will say also on the writing side of things, I know it was harder even for them than it is in the normal submission process because they had invested so much time in the workshop. I mean, they spoke to the other howlers, they were all in it together. And then, you know, to get either an acceptance or a rejection was like more emotionally impactful towards them, you know, because they had more writing on it. So it worked both ways versus a traditional editing versus submission process where it's a little bit more distance between the editors and the submissions. There's a little less of that personal investment or connection writing on it. So again, I haven't done it the traditional way, but I wonder if it's easier or harder. I don't know.
I don't know. It sounds like it would be easier to have that emotional distance and not really have relationship with the writers that you're looking at. I guess my fear is that I would be like the editor that would be like the guy that passed on the Harry Potters, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the reviews have been really good. And what I've liked the most is almost every story has been mentioned in a review as somebody's like top three or at least their favorite. So I feel like that's a good indicator that we selected the right stories because every single story has been mentioned. So that means that, you know, we managed to hit a good balance where the stories that we picked were like they ended up somebody's favorite. Versus like if you'd had an anthology and a couple weren't mentioned, then you're like, oops, you know.
That doesn't happen often. So that's speaking to the, you know, the wide range of audience that you all were able to pull in, you know, and that's pretty cool. If you heard a snort, it's my dog. It's my dog. My dog, I gave her some medicine because the thunderstorm's rolling through and she's like quiet and then she's snoring really big. I'm like, she doesn't know I'm doing a podcast right now, obviously. Oh my gosh.
But yeah, and along with the stories, one nice point that we have is we have a group of artists, so each story has its own illustration. For those who haven't read it yet, the kind of basic tie each story has with each other is the theme that each story is based on an artifact. And so the illustration is of the artifact that appears in the story. And the reader is led through this museum by a curator who who introduces each story slash artifact. I actually wrote the curator. I love him.
Yeah, I like that, how that the consistent story of the, I guess, the curator, the narrator, sort of takes you through all of the other stories and links them together. I did enjoy that. That was really clever, I thought.
I had a lot of fun writing that. It kind of started with the idea that we would write text for the artifact images, much like the flavor text on a magic card. I don't know if you've read any of those. They can tend to be very playful and fun, especially the ones for the goblin cards. And I kind of wanted that slash like a Tales of the Crypt Keeper voice. And then it ended up evolving to like an actual like curator, like leading somebody through a museum, which I think is better.
Yeah, no, I think that worked perfectly. I really enjoyed that. I like that when the anthology stories or the collection stories kind of link together somehow or have an overarching theme. And I like that. PL, what have you been up to lately? Because it's been a while since we spoke with you last.
I've been busy. I think, I don't know if we had mentioned it. So my debut collection came out last March. What Remains When the Stars Burn Out is 12 spooky stories. And I actually did illustrations for each story as well. It was produced by or published by Salt Heart Press. And then actually this December, my debut novella is coming out through Timber Ghost Press. And that is Sisters of the Crimson Vine. You both know this because you both wrote me blurbs. Thank you. So it's
we were excited to do that.
I was so excited.
It's really good. It's really good.
So it's a folk horror based in the 1970s English countryside. It follows John Ainsworth's unfortunate car accident, which leads him waking up in an old convent occupied by 13 unconventional nuns. Things start to get a little spooky, but that's all I'm going to say for your listeners.
I thought the themes in Sisters of the Crimson Vine were very timely and well touched upon. I'm not going to say too much because I don't want to spoil it for anybody that might pick it up, but I read it in two sittings because I was so invested in it. It's so well done. Like as I'm reading it, it's playing out in my mind. And I told you this before, I could see definitely it being a movie just because of the way that it plays out and the plot. Points when it hits, it's like perfect timing and it moves at a great pace. So Netflix, if you're listening,
or Mr. Astor,
anybody who wants to make this would make an excellent movie. It's so well done and the characters are so interesting. I love it.
Thank you, I appreciate that. The nuns were fun characters to write.
I think I told you right off that it just reminded me of an Astor movie. Mm-hmm. Like it's so well detailed and the twists and turns are like, oh my God, you know, that just happened, you know? And it's like, it's subtle. Like it starts out so subtle and you just keep the audio, you know, the reader going like, because we want to know what's coming next. And you just keep on ramping up the tension in these kind of subtle but very powerful ways, and the reader is like, what's going on, and right when we think we might have it figured out, we are totally not right, because then, you know, you very artfully steer us in this other direction. I couldn't stop reading once I started either. I mean, I think I told you that I normally do my big heavy reading for enjoyment at night, is normally what I do, but it carried it. I started it at night, fell asleep because, you know, it was like 12 or something and I had to sleep, but then I got up and I had to read it to the end. And I have not sat and read a book like that in a long while. I think a very long while. So definitely just, it's a page turner, you know, like you want to, it has that mystery. It has definitely the folk-esque aspect, and, you know, you fulfill all of those things with the natural world, I think. And also the, am I right? Monastery? No. Yeah.
The convent.
Yeah, convent. Yeah. Sorry. I'm like, monasteries for dudes, wrong. just with your setting. I mean, you really keep it classic. It's like classic folk horror, which is a little different from what you normally write, correct?
Yeah. It also kind of took me by surprise. I think I've maybe written a single folk horror short story. And then I had this idea of, like, it started out like a very vague idea about how grapes kind of look like little droplets of blood. You know, they're kind of creepy in a way. And I come from, I was brought up Catholic. So there's that whole like idea, like, you know, wine is the blood of Christ and eat of his body and such, like this weird kind of cannibalistic ideology that comes with that type, that part of the worship. So that kind of tied in. And then it slowly spiraled out into what naturally became folk horror. And it's probably so traditionally close to folk horror because, like, you know, I watched the original Wicker Man, and of course I loved Midsummer by Astor. And so I was probably heavily influenced by that, whether or not I meant it to be, but that's how I ended up, I guess, writing it to be a folk horror rather than anything else. There are aspects of cosmic horror because I can't help myself when it comes to that. But I wrote it. It was my first proper novella. Like, I've written novellas before, but I feel like this one was like a proper good one. I actually planned it out because I don't often outline. I was like, how do I outline this? Like, oh, heck, I don't want to go chapter by chapter. So I ended up dividing it into the steps it takes to make wine, actually, which you may have noticed, but each part is titled the step that is taken in winemaking. So harvesting of the grapes and the, you know, clarification and then the bottling, et cetera. So I ended up dividing it into those parts, and that's how I divided my story and planned it. And then it just ended up being the folk horror it is. I guess fair warning to your listeners, being a traditional folk horror story, it is a slow build, although it is a novella, so it doesn't have much room to stay slow. So at least there's that. But yeah, I really enjoyed writing it. I'm gonna miss the sisters.
So you also, did you intend to have such a, because it is folk, but I'd also call it, like, you know, ecological kind of horror, you know, it has those aspects to it. It also has a very powerful, at least to me, a very powerful, like, if I was going to teach this in a class, and I totally would, you know, someday I'm going to teach this book, because it conquers ecological, it really goes after folk, but you also have this very speaking to religious patriarchy and feminist, you know, your sisters in some ways remind me of the Red Women that I wrote, you know, and it's like a reaction to extreme, I guess, male themes that are often are in horror, or men trying to write women in horror. And your main character is a male. but you still are able to take on some of these feminist ideals, you know, through the characters. And did you intend that? Because without getting into it, the theme that drives them, the women, is so powerful, you know, and it really kind of does this weird twist, and you don't know at the end how you 100% feel about the females in the story. You still like them, but you still fear them, you know. But their power comes from this need of, like, they're essentially abandoned, you know, they're abandoned and left to just kind of pick up the pieces. And they do it in such a powerful way that, you know, by the end of the story, you're like, you know, I fear you, I get you, I think, mostly. like, you're scary, but you're also very beautiful, not just in like beauty, but like, you're beautiful because you're so powerful. Like, you took on this power, you literally called forth this power, you know. And I just found it so wonderfully powerful what you were doing there. I said powerful like 5 times. I found what you did with the female characters to be so timely for today, and just wonderfully written, you know, that it was inspiring to me as a female writer of horror as well, you know. So I guess I'm wondering, did you intend that? What were you thinking when you were writing that part of the story, and without telling everybody about it?
So there's in regards to that question, I do feel like there are multiple aspects that went into how I decided and how I wrote the characters, whether they were male or female, but especially the nuns in the story. So as a person, you know, I am a feminist. I think whether they identify as a feminist or not, a person going through life, if they're you know, a woman or somebody who identifies as a woman or a female, you see a lot of, you get forced into a lot of positions where you might feel powerless. You know, whether you go to the car dealership and the salesman is like, oh, you don't know about cars, this one goes vroom vroom, you know. I had thought, like, I had a salesman try to explain a clutch to me, and I was like, okay, calm down. Or growing up, in the times that we did, hopefully it's getting better now, but like, I was told not to run up the stairs. It's not ladylike, like, be quiet. It's not ladylike to speak up. Like, from a young age, you're kind of told to act a certain way, or you're not being ladylike. And restrictions are put on you. The Catholic religion, especially, like, women are seen almost like, you know, barefoot in the kitchen, pregnant. And being also somebody who intends never to have children, like, I am a child-free person. It was doubling on that, like, where it felt like I was like, I don't want to have that. And it's often, oh, well, what about what your husband's going to want? You're being so selfish. What if he wants children and you're taking that away from him? It's like, then he can go find somebody else. So there is like that side of me that will always, all my stories, all my books are going to have kind of that side to them, just by essence of me as a person, because that is the experience of who I am, and that's what I've seen in my life. You know, being told I'm selfish for not being a standard childbearing person, or, you know, saying, oh, like, women don't act like that, you're being too loud, or like, whatever. I had an editor tell me that one of my female characters, he thought was a male because the character was very sexually aggressive. And I was like, I think that says more about the women you know than the women I do. So it can be very frustrating in that way. So that is obviously going to bleed out into my stories. But I absolutely did want the nuns to be somebody, like, as characters that the reader would be unsure of how to feel about. I didn't want to write a one-dimensional where the main character is a good guy and the nuns are bad women. I wanted it to be like, at the end, you're left with this confusion, like, how should I feel about these nuns? Like, and I'm glad I achieved that. Like, I didn't want them to be necessarily good or evil. Like, I wanted them to be, I mean, most convents, in essence, if people didn't choose to become nuns, oftentimes they were sent there because they were doing things or had things done to them that their families didn't want getting out. Like, if they had gotten pregnant, if they liked other women, if they spoke up too much, if they had like a mental illness, you know, send them to the convent out of sight, which is why I kind of set it there. I picked the 1970s because there's a drought at that time, which of course ties into the folk horror, but it's also close enough in history to World War II. And of course, you know what happens in the story in the nun's past, where effectively they were abandoned by the church. And then in the story, two church auditors have come because they believe that the convent should be paying profit to the church from the vineyard, which of course is that male presence coming and being like, hey, you're not doing what we want you to, like, give us what we feel we are entitled to, even though we didn't help you when you needed it. Which obviously ties into the idea of like, these women were sent to the convent, or maybe some of them chose to be there, but they have their own space, which is now being invaded by people who feel entitled to what they have. And, you know, I did kind of write the nuns in a way. I feel a lot of women, when they're put in an uncomfortable position where they feel like they either can't or shouldn't say an outright no, they'll just be coldly polite, almost like a weapon. Like, whether it be like you're at a convention and a man won't leave you alone. Oftentimes, even in broad daylight, women will fear saying no because who knows what will happen to them. And men, a lot of men don't understand that. But, you know, I feel like it's happened to everyone who's female identifying. I worked at a bookshop cafe in college. And I remember I was on a shift with another guy who flirted with me a lot, and I just ignored it. Because, like, what do you do if you like outright shut them down? They'll often get hostile, and then it's an awkward work environment. So you just kind of like brush it off. Well, I had to go get stock from the basement, and he followed me down, and he was like, I want a hug from you. I want a hug. And I was like pinned in this room. I ended up having to like hurdle over this giant box of books and like to escape back into the public space. But like, even then I was like, I like keep him calm, like don't instigate anything. And I know I'm not the only one who's experienced that. And I guess I kind of channeled that rage at being helpless into my nuns, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And I think you did it in a very effective way where you don't feel like you're hit over the head with that, but it comes across crystal clear. And like you said, we've all been in those positions. I'm a little bit older than you guys, both of you, not so much, but I'm older than you. So, I mean, I remember a time when girls weren't allowed to wear pants to school, required to wear dresses, even if it was a freaking blizzard outside. Kind of a thing, right? And you weren't allowed to have a credit card in your own name. You couldn't have a bank account in your own name without your dad's sign. That was in the 70s. That wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. And kind of the environment that we're in now, it's fearful to me that we might go back to that, because there are men that really want that. They don't want you as an equal. They don't want you in their workplace. They definitely don't want you as their boss. I mean, I worked for the Department of Defense for a lot of years, and being the only female on a team, every day was this engineer would come in and basically quiz me and grill me to see if I knew my shit. And like you said, he's the lead engineer. I have to keep everything chill. So I would just be like, yeah, you know, I'd answer his questions, blah, blah, blah. And inside I would be like almost terrified to come to work. Cause it's like, what if I get one wrong? They're going to fire me. And at that time, you know, as a single mom with a little kid at home, and just, yeah, I think everybody can relate to those feelings. And I think that you convey that really well with the nuns when the auditors show up and everybody's like, well, you know, screw you. I've made my safe space here, and now here you are. Like, so yeah, I think that was very effective in the story, and the message comes across quite clear. And I know that we have some male listeners, and you guys are all probably thinking in your heads right now, well, not all men. Well, listen up, guys. Maybe you're not the kind of guy that would corner a woman in a basement, but are you the kind of guy that stands by quietly and watches it happen? Hold your brethren to account. That's mm-hmm. all I'm going to say. I got some backlash for that a while ago, telling men to hold other men accountable. So come at me, guys.
I mean, but it's true. Like, as a male listener, if you feel like it sounds pretty offensive, then like, yeah, next time, like if it looks like a guy's like kind of like got a girl pinned into a corner at the bar, like force yourself to go up and see if she's okay. Like a lot of guys wouldn't, like, if we're being honest. And again, that places it on women to like step in and hope that having enough numbers will work, which can be scary too.
Yeah.
Or even to speak up as a woman, you know, to let someone else, to let people know that you're having a problem, you know, mm-hmm. because there's backlash and shame that can come out of that.
Yeah.
Stuff. And I find that especially true for, I mean, women in all kinds of places, but women in particular, I think in the horror genre, it can be, you can end up in some problematic spaces, or, you know, having to answer emails or Facebook messages or, you know, stuff like that, like weird questions that, like, would you ask me that, like, normally? But what's in a yeah. horror writer? What, like, what makes that okay? You know, I do write the darkness, but that's my daughter laughing. But that doesn't, I don't know, there's like a standard of professionalism that I think sometimes gets forgotten. Mm-hmm. That is definitely, men just automatically have it, you know, especially white men over a certain age, I think, as writers. But you have to kind of claw to be able, you have to claw your way to that place to be able, and maybe you don't know, maybe we don't have that specific power, you know what I mean? It's even hard for us to talk to other female writers about it, but we've all experienced different things to a certain degree, you know, and stuff. But I think it's time we start having those conversations so we can change the way things are, you know, and it's not always easy.
Well, I mean, you see it all the time, right? Like, women will see another woman on the street possibly being having a hard time, and you'll walk up to her and pretend like you know her when you really don't. Be like, do you need a ride? Oh, you know, we're waiting to get her away from the situation. And you'll see men just walking past the situation. Mm-hmm. So what I'm really asking for any male listener that's listening to this, if you're feeling called out, you are being called out. It's time for you guys to hold your brethren accountable. Other men need to hold men accountable, to treat women with respect and professionalism, period. So anyways, that's all I'm going to say about that. Otherwise, you might show up in one of our novels and unpleasant things could possibly occur to you.
But yeah, I like kind of on a similar note, I remember, and this is kind of interesting too, is like, even inside horror fiction, women are often kind of treated as fodder or exhibitions to be seen, which I kind of explore. My male character, the main character is male, poor John Ainsworth, just trying his best, average male white guy, no offense to you white guys out there. The reader sees the events through John's eyes, effectively. Like, I kind of wanted to write it as the idea of like the male gaze. The nuns do kind of tell him, like, hey, like, you know, stick to your room, don't come to our sanctuary. So like John definitely creeps about and peeks in the sanctuary, you know, like, you know, at one point even peeks in a window. John, what are you doing? You're being a terrible guest.
Yeah, he's like getting into their stuff and his need to figure out the mystery, you know.
Yeah, and so it's kind of that idea as well, because I mean, anyone who's a fan of horror, like, you cannot deny, you know, how many times have you watched a horror movie and then it's like, titties are out, interesting, I wonder if this is relevant to the plot, or maybe you're just like, yeah, titties, you know. But like the amount of times, like, there's like just a sex scene thrown in, or even worse, if it's, I hate this genre of horror, I don't, it's just awful. And I can always tell the movie, it's going to be about this, if it has like this bloodied female character as like the screen on Netflix, and then the warnings are like sexual assault, like violence. I'm like, okay, so this is going to be about a woman who gets raped, and then she has to go and get revenge. And it's just so gross, because it minimalizes the damage that rape can do to somebody, both mentally and physically. I'm not gonna get into that, I just find it so upsetting. And then like the male writer is just like, and then she gets her own, I'm helping women out with this. But I don't even know what the intent of these movies are, because they feel so flippant. Sometimes the rape scenes are so over the top and long, and it's like, why are we like, this feels gross, like, why does this need to be a thing? Why are we so focused on having these women raped and punished? And like, I guess you're giving comeuppance, but really, like, it, you know, the way women have been treated in the genre itself as characters, it's been really not great. Not great.
Yeah, I agree. I know I have some scenes that definitely, you know, run alongside terror and the pain women's bodies go through. But I'm also telling it through, unfortunately, experience. And it's written, so when you're writing from that vantage point, it's not about, it's almost like, I know in one scene, definitely something's going on, but she's vacated her body. She's focused on the stars. She's floating above. And that honestly is something that happens to women when we are undergoing that kind of violence. Like, we are trying so hard. If you can't get out of it, you try to get out of your body. Nobody writes that, mm-hmm. you know. It is written mostly from a very highly sexualized male gaze. And that there's nothing sexual about it going it's so on, gross. You know? And yeah. And that's that has been kind of what has always been going on, you know, is this writing of female trauma, female pain, female loss of power. And it's always got this kind of sexual slant to it. And that's not at all what is going on when a woman is assaulted. There's nothing. It shouldn't even be in my book called sexual assault, because it is not, there's nothing about it that's sexual. It's terror, it's pain, you know, it's assault. And so, you know, you and I've talked about this, you know, and stuff, because just being able to have, to be able to do horror, and reverse that narrative and subvert it and, you know, finally have women's voices out there, you know, is important. I, there just needs not be any more men who are writing about our trauma, especially that kind of trauma. Like, it's been done enough. Thank you, guys. Take a back seat, you know?
And especially when, like, there's nothing that, like, both frustrates and angers me more than if I read a story or watch a show and there's, you know, violence against like a woman, or even just, you know, a protracted sex scene. Like, this is, I guess, particular in shows, because obviously then they're filming this woman naked and it's protracted, and then it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the plot. It's just obvious there for the viewers to get their sex on, you know. Like, if it's a horror movie and they're just like, okay, let's put a, like, you know, in a slasher, and like, I'm gonna, like, I'm like, you know, they're having sex and the slutty girl's in bed and she's got big bouncy titties, stab stab stab, now she's dead. It's like, okay, so the sex scene was just to get her naked so we could kill her while her tits are out, you know. There's nothing, there's no need for it beyond that. It's just so the viewers can see some boobs in the movie, and it's just so annoying, because like, it's so obvious, it's so clear, and it's like, I hope the genre gets past that. Like, as a writer, like, too, it's like, if it's not necessary to the story, like, it, do you need to write in a weird sex scene with this woman? You know, I see it a lot with male writers where it'll just be like, random sex scene, and then like, especially if they've written from the female point of view, and then, you know, she's describing everything that's happening, it's like, oh, come on, like.
This, yeah,
unnecessary.
Like, women aren't going to do that. Or like, when you have a description, if it's, not to keep on, well, yeah, I'm going to keep on ragging on the male writers, but when they're writing a female character and like, she's looking at herself in the mirror and, you know, examining her erect
nipples. Why are our nipples always erect?
I'm like, they obviously have not even consulted a woman about how we look ourselves in the mirror. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I've offered feedback to some guy writer friends of mine, and I will say, why is this scene in here? This doesn't like move the plot forward. This doesn't give me insight to the character. Why are we doing this? And either the comments are completely ignored, or they argue back that, well, this is what people do. Well, yeah, I know that, but like I'm saying, it's not revealing character. It's not moving the plot. It feels gratuitous. I'm telling you, as a woman reader, I don't like it. And they just dismiss it sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I think male writers might do well to listen to some sensitivity readers from female viewpoints about what they're writing. And, you know, because I rarely, if ever, think of my tits throughout the day, just so you're aware.
Yeah.
I think the only time I really considered my tits throughout the day was when I was breastfeeding my children. Other than that, they just, you know, it doesn't really come into my day-to-day existence.
Well, it makes you wonder, too, when the consideration of who your readership is. And honestly, I think a lot of male writers, for the most part, are probably writing for other males of their similar background, ethnicity, and age group. You know, am I wrong? I might be wrong, but you know, and that certainly doesn't excuse it, but I don't know. It's just, it's definitely something that still needs to be rectified and worked on. I think in horror, you know, just how the female body is treated and how female and female identifying writers are treated. you know, in general. I mean, lots of groups of people, let's be honest. Outside of, you know, white male authors.
I mean, the good news is that I'm seeing a lot more female writers take these subjects by the reins and just run with it. Evie Knight's 3 Days in the Pink Tower looks at rape from a completely different gaze than you probably are used to reading it in horror. And it kind of is a rape revenge story, but not in the traditional sense. It's more of a personal empowerment, spiritual, physical, mental revenge that she takes in the story to overcome what happened to her.
Yeah, and she's very open about that. And she gave you a blurb too, right? Yep. For this one.
Yeah, she's awesome. So I'm really happy to see a lot of that happening. More female writers are coming on the scene, I think, and I'm really excited about it. I think now is a good time to be a female horror writer.
Yeah, it's definitely been refreshing as somebody who reads, I read a lot of books, and to be able to be in the time where I can read beyond like the standard, like King and Straub's and everything like that. There's a glut of amazing authors out there that are covering a wide range of viewpoints and perspectives, and it's just been a good time to be a reader, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I just finished reading some of V. Castro's work, and I think she has a new book out. I think it just launched maybe a couple of days ago, but she's writing the story of the, is it Hernandez from Aliens?
Yes.
So I really want to get my hands on that. That looks amazing. So, I mean, we're seeing, and she like is unapologetically feminist writer, like mm-hmm. unapologetic, and writes it from a culture of viewpoint that you don't hear a lot about. But even I saw a Twitter thread with her, I think it was a couple of days ago. She just was commenting that she would like to see more media, movies and such, pick up more Latino, Latina writers. And the comments in that thread were just like ridiculous. People are like, oh, well, then you just haven't looked hard enough. Here's movies from the 60s and 70s. And she's like, no, I mean like now. And people were listing off Guillermo del Toro and all of that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's great. But where are the women? Where are the women telling these stories? They're not there. But the fact that people were like, this was a hill that people were going to die on. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, but I was a little bit. It's kind of like, gosh, can't you even take 5 minutes to see someone's viewpoint instead of just trying to argue with them why they're wrong? I don't know. It's just very frustrating sometimes, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of male readers can be like, oh, feminist horror? Do you just like kill men all the time? I actually had a guy say that to me. At a convention, which still baffles me to this day because I keep bringing it up. I keep thinking about it. And I think it made me afraid to write feminist horror for a while because I didn't want to be labeled a man eater. But like, the thing is, like, I'm a horror writer. I'm going to kill everyone. Everyone dies in my stories. That's not true. But everyone's at risk of dying, like male, female, non-binary, like whatever sexual preference. I might kill you in my stories, like, because I'm a horror writer. If your death would fit the story's narrative, you're going to die. But will my fiction have a feminist slant to it? Of course, because I am a woman and that's my perspective. Do I think men should be afraid to read female authors? No, like it might widen your perspective. It might give you chills in a different way because you're reading from a different perspective. It's going to be uncomfortable for you, but isn't that what horror is supposed to be about? It's like the same reason, but like a different vibe. Like it's the same reason I watch foreign horror movies because they treat horror differently and it will make it scarier because it's new. It's going to be the same thing. Also, call out for a good sci-fi horror, Hayley Piper's Your Mind is a Terrible Thing. It actually has a non-binary character as the main character, So not only is it like a really good read, but it's also a good, as a writer, a good thing to read to be like, how do I write a non-binary character? How do you treat this? So.
Right. So, I mean, reading widely from different types of authors definitely will just increase your writing, improve writing across the board. Because I think, and I know that there was a little bit of backlash not long ago about male writers complaining about it's hard for them to get a publishing contract right now because more diverse voices are taking those spaces, I guess. But the thing is that if you were to read more widely and write more accessible things, it would not be, well, I don't think it's an issue to begin with, but maybe that would help resolve some of those issues for male writers. But I mean, if you just look at everything that's published, 85% is male writers. So I'm not sure what they're complaining about. So.
Yeah. And like you said it nicely, I guess I'll put it more bluntly. Like if you're somebody who's writing the same old thing, and for a lot of male writers, like oftentimes I see like the male MC, you know, who has like a tough family life and he's struggling to get by or like whatever, like it's boring, like we've read it so many times, like King has covered every angle of it, like swear to God, like that might be why it's not selling, because we have too much of it. Like readers want something new and scary and spooky, and they want unique voices because they tell unique stories. So if you're writing about the white male protagonist who brings his 2.5 children and housewife to a new house and it's haunted, and oh no, how's he going to deal with it? His wife is being a nag and his children don't understand him and his work is, he's struggling at work. It's like, we've heard it all before, to be honest. No offense.
That's the number one genre thing, that the trope that will, like, I'll immediately stop when the house is haunted and the wife tells the husband and he doesn't believe her. I'm like, yeah, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah. Just like it gets repetitive. It's like, I often compare reading to eating. It's like, I don't want a ham and cheese sandwich anymore. I want a steak. And if you're not giving me a good steak, if I want a ham and cheese sandwich, I'll read Stephen King's old stuff. Like, you know, I don't need to like waste my time on like buying books and reading about helpless girlfriends and wives and the big cool male protagonist trying to protect his family from the spooky house or the spooky ghost or the werewolf or the vampire or whatever. You know, I want to read something new. I'm a greedy person when it comes to what I consume, and I want new. You know, who doesn't? I want the next new toy. I want it to be shiny, full of batteries or something. Wait, that sounded a bit different.
I was just like thinking that of our earlier conversation before I got
on. Oops, I didn't mean like that. Or did I?
Or did you? Maybe you did. Freudian slip there, perhaps. Okay, so PL, we have talked a little bit about your novella that's coming out, Sisters of the Crimson Vine, and we were hoping that you would read an excerpt for us today.
I would love to. So this comes from, it's not at the very beginning of the novella. So this is just a little morsel to get the listeners revved up again. Coming out December 6th, but you can get your pre-orders in now. So this is an excerpt from Sisters of the Crimson Vine. I woke up, rising through tendrils of clinging sleep. Moonlight fell softly across the empty beds like ghostly whispers. A weak wind whistled against the windows, rustling the trees I could see through the glass. I pushed myself up to a seated position, rubbing my face and feeling overheated. I thought of the conversation at dinner and groaned. What must the nuns think of me getting drunk and then rambling on about God and religion? I'm such an ass, I said, staring up at the ceiling. Just outside my door, something scraped against the stone. A chill rolled down my spine as I froze in my bed. My fists still pressed against my forehead. It was an irregular sound. Scrape, scrape, pause, scrape, long pause. In the otherwise silent convent, the sound was as loud as a scream and sent goosebumps all over my body. The low moan that accompanied the scraping made my shiver deepen. Caught in the grip of a growing foreboding and yet unable to resist my own curiosity, I got out of bed, balancing on my good foot. I hopped over to the door, trying to be silent, and pressed my ear against the wood. Accompanying the scraping was a low, desperate moan punctuated by panting. All these sounds created a sickly cacophony, the dirge of a dying beast trying to find a safe place to leave behind its mortal prison, a dark corner in which to die. I put my hand on the knob and paused. It might be better to just go back to bed, hide under the covers like I had when I was a little boy. But like in a bad dream, I couldn't resist opening the door just a crack. Just past my door, crawling his way towards the entrance, was Father O'Halloran. He was dressed in a threadbare old-fashioned nightshirt, and his whole body was convulsing. He had one arm stretched out, fingers digging into the grout between the stones, pulling himself along, a man-sized slug. He looked up as I opened the door and stared down at him. "Help me," he whimpered. I went down on my good knee, stretching the plaster-bound leg out to the side. "What are you doing?" I whispered. "Do you need me to take you back to your room?" I reached out to him and he gripped my hand in his. I could feel how cold and clammy his skin was, and I wanted to pull away in revulsion. "The food," he gasped. "The food." "Yes, Father, I heard you got food poisoning. How about I get you back to your room and get you some water?" As I said that, I remembered my leg and tried to think of how I would even be able to help at all. I leaned out farther, looking up and down the hall, hoping a nun might be taking a nighttime walk or patrol or prayer, whatever it is nuns might do at night. I thought about going upstairs and knocking on a door to get someone to help, but realized that I didn't even know which room might be Agatha's or Helena's. Then I thought of Father Griffith. Of course. He was on the same floor and would be able to carry Father O'Halloran back to bed. The deacon jerked my hand, pulling me down towards him. I could smell his breath, tinged with the thick aftermath of vomit. "You must take me elsewhere. Take me out of here, to the village, or..." His whole body shook so hard, he dropped my hand, curling in on himself, his head tapping against the stone floor. I gripped the doorframe, pulling myself up. "I'm going to get someone to help." He moaned, a sad, wheedly noise, then tried to reach for me again. "Agatha," I called, my voice echoing through the night-shrouded hall. "Father Griffith?" "No, no, no," the deacon panted. "Anyone?" I reached for my crutches. The man retched, his whole body heaving, his back humping up as he vomited onto the floor. A thin, watery pool of black bile funneled between the stones, a foul-smelling rivers. "Oh, dear," a shivery voice full of amusement. I looked up and saw a nun walking towards us. She wasn't one I'd formally met, and I was at a loss for her name, but she was stunningly beautiful. Her thick red hair hung down in heavy curls to her waist, unbraided or tamed in any way. Her pale skin was spectral in the darkness, seeming to float since her black habit was almost invisible in the shadows. She looked tall, towering over us as she approached. Then she deigned to sink to our level, kneeling and pressing a hand to the back of Father O'Halloran's neck. She looked up at me. Her eyes were dark, endless, and I could feel myself falling into them. "He's running a fever," she said, breaking her enchantment over me. The deacon whimpered as she rolled him over, not very gently at that, treating him like he was a sack of grain to be inventoried rather than a suffering human being. "I thought it was food poisoning," I said, looking down at O'Halloran's panic-stricken face. "It's the stomach flu, poor man." He was still reaching for my hand, though now his eyes were closed, and he was whimpering his way through a frenzied prayer. "Maybe we should take him to a hospital," I said, staring down at him with pity. "Of course, I'll be sending someone to the village immediately, but until then, he's in good hands, just like you," the nun said, and her smile gleamed in the darkness. She slipped an arm around the deacon and stood, pulling his limp body up with her like he was a doll. I stared up at her, shocked at the surprising strength she had just shown. She made her way back down the hall, taking Father O'Halloran with her, his feet dragging along the floor. I watched her take him into his room, and then his door shut. I stayed there listening. The warm night wind whistled through the hall, rushing in from the open end that led to the vineyard. It was a long time before I left my threshold vigil, wincing at my cramping leg, and hopped back to bed. And that was my excerpt from Sisters of the Crimson Vine.
Thank you so much, PL. And again, that's coming out December 6th, open for pre-orders from Timber Ghost Press. I thoroughly enjoyed this story. Like I said, I read it in two sittings, which is unusual for me. I love all of the characters, the themes. It's so well done. And above all, it is creepy, creepy, creepy.
I feel the same way. It was definitely, yeah. It just unfolded like a movie, like an Astor movie in my head. It just, I think immediately as soon as I finished, well, I think I just was messaging him even before I finished it. I was like, oh my God.
I remember that, yeah.
It's crafted so well. It is super, it has so many things in it. It's creepy. It's tense. The tension just slowly ramps up, you know, kind of like, I actually had that same kind of tension kind of feeling that I had watching Midsommar, honestly. Mm-hmm. You know, that was what I connected it to when I was
reading. Definitely an inspiration. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's definitely different. Like, I don't want the listeners to think that it's the same kind of tale, but it's the tension and I would say the crafting and the art of storytelling is very much similar in that way, you know, just what you did with the symbology and I mean, I can you call something literary folk horror, because that's what I would call this. Like, I would love to see this novella win a lot of awards, because it's that well written. It is classic. It will be classic. I don't see how it can't be. I mean, and I'm not kidding. It is so, so good. It's such a great read.
I'm going to have to hire you to be my hype person.
Right?
Oh, I'll hype you. I will hype you so much.
Describes it perfectly. Absolutely. Well, PL, thank you so much for joining us again here on The Burial Plot. We just love chatting with you. I'm feeling like after December 6th, when this comes out, I want to have a book club just around this story so that I can unpack all of these things from it. PL, where can people not only find links for the pre-order of this novella, but where can we find more information about all of your work?
So definitely visit my website at plmcmillan.com. The last name is M-C-M-I-L-L-A-N. I have a link to the pre-orders there. As well as links to pretty much everything I've been in. I also blog there. So I do book, movie, video game reviews. I actually just finished a 7-day October challenge where I wrote 7 stories in 7 days based on 7 prompts from my readers. Wow. So there is free to read stuff on there as well, plus links to all my socials. So again, that's plmcmillan.com.
And we'll put the link to that in the show notes. And listeners, thanks again for joining us. I hope that you've enjoyed the return of The Burial Plot. I'm Joy Yaley, your co-host, and I'm here with Brenda Tolian. I can be reached at joyyaley.com. And Brenda, where are you at?
I think I'm still at brendatolian.com, but I'm also on Twitter, I think as myself. I'm everywhere. I hear.
So search us out.
And we'll be waiting.
That's right. Until next time, listeners, stay above ground.